Jenny felt the cold water engulf her body as she entered the sea. The light dimmed above her, and she could barely make out the faces of her boyfriend, Sunny, and the boatsmen who were with them. She was out here for a dive with Sunny. Okay, remember my training? Jenny might have been thinking as she lowered herself deeper and deeper into the water. About a minute passed. Maybe it's time for me to head up? Before ascending, her boyfriend told her to take a deep breath, hold it in, and then ascend up gradually. Her vision started blurring, and the space behind her eyes felt tight. She was trying to pull herself up, but her arms were hurting. What's going on? The space behind her eyes felt like something was pushing out, as if it was erupting. Then, her ears popped. You're listening to Heinous, an Asian true crime podcast brought to you by MediaCorp and produced by One Up Media. I'm your host, Yeo Gwang-jin. But first, our partner this week is Asia in the Shadows, a true crime podcast. The podcast features true crimes from all over Asia, the largest and most diverse continent on the planet. Every Wednesday, join your host, Christine Abregana, also known as the host of La Gim, a Filipino true crime podcast, as she features a different country in Asia and a different crime story that you might not have heard before. Follow Asia in the Shadows, link in the episode description. Now back to Heinous. How the police would come to suspect Sunny Ang would remain a mystery to us for a while. In the last episode, we learned that on the 27th of August 1963, Sunny and Jenny went to Pulau Dua for a dive. She went in and never came out. All this time, Sunny was with the boatsman who identified that to be true. In other words, he had an alibi on the time of Jenny's death. However, we knew he was a bankrupt, and it wouldn't take long for the police to learn about that as well. In the 1960s, the police laid the foundations for Singapore to be safe today. According to Singapore government's latest numbers, we had about 37,000 cases of crime. With a population of 5.7 million, that would put our crime rates under 1%. So you can imagine how relentless the entire organization needs to be to keep those numbers in check. But Sunny didn't know that. And what we learned was that in the 16 months leading up to Sunny's arrest, the police would speak to many people and discover intimate details about Sunny's life and discover a clear motive. They spoke first to Sunny's old flying club, where he used to train for his pilot's license, and learned that he made a curious inquiry. He asked about the risk of flying and mentioned that Jenny intended to join the club as a student pilot. He also made an inquiry to an insurance agency and proceeded to insure her for $200,000 on personal accident risk. That would be worth $800,000 today if adjusted for inflation alone. At this point, we thought it sort of made sense that if you love someone, you might want to introduce them to the sport that you love as well and cover them for insurance if the sport is dangerous. Except that the police discovered that he approached another insurance agency for the same inquiries and covered her for another $150,000. But perhaps what was deeply unsettling was a law firm that Sunny contacted just 3 weeks before Jenny's disappearance. Sunny had brought her there to draft out her will, where her entire estate and expectations of $1.3 million in today's value was to be given to a mysterious Madam Yobi Neo, whom Jenny had never met. So who is Madam Yeo? As far as we can tell, records to Madame Yeo Bin-yeo was incredibly sparse. However, some key memories of her life are well recorded. It was the 21st of December, 1964. Madame Yeo Bin-yeo was seated at home where she could smell the faint smell of ammonia. She was visiting her son, who started poultry farming in the early 1960s. Ah, my boy has come a long way, she might have thought, as she observes her son preparing a new land to grow tomatoes. It felt like only yesterday that he was that childish boy. Her mind began to drift off to younger times. Her son, Su Swan, loves cars, but at that time, they would still cost a good deal of money. So one day, when her husband found $6,000 to $7,000 missing, there was some suspicion. But the theft looked like an outsider had stolen the money, so they informed the police accordingly. It wasn't long before they came back with Su Swan and showed a receipt detailing that he purchased a car for around $6,000 to $7,000. She remembered that he was lying all the way, denying it, even when the police said that they tailed him and saw him handing over the money. Her heart aches as she recalled her husband driving him out and only letting him back a couple of days later when she forgave him. He was a filial and kind son, which was why she was taken by surprise when on the 21st of December, 1964, the police came knocking at her door and demanded to see Su Swan. Aren't you the police? Wait, why are you here? Why do you want to take my boy Sunny? From the records, we learned that Madame Yeo Bin-yeo was Sunny's mother, who had never really met Jenny formally at all, but was entitled to all of Jenny's estate through her will. While piecing together the reports, we learned that the prosecution brought 16 circumstantial evidence against Sunny Ang. And most suspicious of all was the $900,000 insurance payout that Sunny took for Jenny from several insurance companies that would translate to about 3 million SGD today, and his eagerness to claim it. He reported her death in less than 24 hours and even wanted to settle for half the insurance payout as long as he could get it sooner. On May 19, 1965, a jury convicted him of murder and he was given the death penalty for his actions. It would seem that there was no way out for Sunny Ang, except the room was dead silent. Where did that clap come from? The jury might have wondered. The attention turned towards Sunny Ang in the stand, his hands clasped together. Sunny showed a faint smile and was calm. The eerie calmness was familiar to us. We recalled reading it somewhere. But where was it? The memory of Madame Yeo, Sunny's mother, reminded us of something. When Sunny stole from his father and subsequently was found guilty, he also went away calmly. That very same calm was a reassurance that the punishment would never happen, and that he had everything under control. True enough, back then, while his father drove him away, his mother welcomed him back, and everything seemed back to normal in just a couple of days. This smile that Sunny gave, it signaled a war. On 25th of October, 1965, 5 months after his trial, Sunny Ang was reading his books calmly. He had been waking up at 6:30 a.m., leaving his cell twice a day, one to shower and one to exercise, before sleeping at 10:30 p.m. every day for the past 152 days. But today, his itinerary would change. Get ready, a prison warden said. Today, Sun Yang would leave the prison and be present in his appeal before Justice Tan Ah Tah, Justice Chua, and Justice Winslow. He was brimming in confidence. Everything was going according to plan. Except, it did not. Mr. Kumar Goswami, who was Sunny's attorney, brought everything to the appeal. And at the very end of the 9-day trial, Acting Chief Justice said, although Jenny's body has never been found, there was overwhelming evidence on the record that the appellant murdered her. In our judgment, no miscarriage of justice has occurred in this case. The appeal is dismissed. Sun Yang would return to his prison cell routine, but as he was driven back, he knew it was only a matter of time that he would be driven out. In just about 1 year's time, Sun Yang might actually be right. He began his appeal to the Privy Council. But first, our partners this week is a Brief Case podcast. Teddy, or you can call her Daddy. Every week, she takes a brief look at the murder, madness, and minds of the true crime in Asia. Follow a Brief Case podcast by clicking in the link in the description. Here's a soundbite.
Get your dirty hands off her coffin.
He opens a gambling den in the temple itself. Another thing is that, are you supposed to be giving your name to the devil? You know?
I mean, if you ask politely.
Hi, I'm Teddy, and welcome to A Brief Case.
Now back to heinous. The Privy Council is the highest court of appeal for specific British territories and remain an option for Singaporeans to appeal to them before 1994, where it was abolished. It was 1966, so it was still an option for Sun Yang, except his petition for special leave to appeal to the Privy Council was denied, and Sun Yang remained in prison. The strange calm that surrounded his cell gave way to a feeling of anxiety. A prison guard looked over at Sun Yang, and for the first time, he wasn't smiling. This man writes feverishly. The prison guard must have thought to himself, it wasn't the first time that he was receiving letters that he needed to mail for Sun Yang. These letters were interesting, as there were some key words that appeared across all of them. He read those words. Exercise. Fly. Rope. Helicopter. Wait. It seems almost as if these letters, they were coded. Over the past year, while Sun Yang was planning what he would do inside the law, he was also planning what he would do outside it. And these letters were not just musing of his time and connections with his family. These letters were coded letters meant to be sent to his accomplice. He had intended to get his friend to fly a helicopter over to the prison, drop a rope during his exercise time, where he would fly and be flown away. But these letters would never reach, because the prison wardens and team would have intercepted the entire message from the very first letter. Just like how his legal escape was a fantasy in his mind, his dramatic escape would only remain on the letters that he wrote. On January 1967, 3 months after he was denied the Privy Council, he was rejected by President Yusof bin Ishak for clemency. And along that rejection, Sun Yang would see a date, 6 February 1967, the day that his execution was official. He only had a week before it would happen. And again, he wasn't smiling. As we continued to piece together Sun Yang's story, it seems increasingly clear that he was on his way to the noose. But one thing was missing from us. How did he kill Jenny Chok? In every record that we went through, there were only hypotheses, until we stumbled on one story told by a visitor who met Sun Yang nearing the end of his days. "I was suffering an injustice," Sun Yang told the visitor. Here we go again. the visitor thought. But something felt different this time. I was suffering an injustice because that's not how I killed Jenny. In the 1963 copy of Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, there was a section on diving and ascent. It stated a condition. If a diver breathing compressed air holds his breath during the ascent, the pressure inside the lungs would build up. If the pressure is too high, air is forced into the bloodstream, causing bubbles to form inside the blood itself. Those bubbles will be transported to the left ventricle of the heart and then to the brain. This would lead to injury and death while ascending during a dive. According to Harrison, you would only need 4 meters of depth for this to happen. And Sunny Ang knew this, because on the day of his arrest, that very book was found in his collection. Sunny Ang took what Harrison intended as a manual to future physicians and used it as a weapon to kill Jenny Chok. In all his diving trips with her, he wasn't coaching her to dive. He was coaching her to die. The visitor was then told by Sunny himself that he never wanted to hide the body. He didn't want to kill her through any other means either, because he needed the body to be found. He needed them to run a post-mortem and discover the death via quick ascent during the dive. As far as we can tell, there was no reason for the visitor to have lied about this encounter with Sunny and for the claims to be fabricated. But we acknowledged that it was just one visitor's claim. It was recorded that after the rejection by the Privy Council, he acknowledged the futility of his escape plans. He would cry, convert to Christianity, express regret to his family in his will, before dying on the February 6, 1967 at dawn by hanging. In all our research on Sunny Ang, we learned a couple of things. We learned that Pulau Dua is the sister's island that we know today, and that Jenny met Sunny at Jardin Steps, otherwise known as Harbour Front, to take her on her last boat trip before she vanished. But we also wanted to catch a glimpse of how Sunny felt in his final days, because historical records are contradicting. Some would say that he walked a full 100 pace, confidently and seemed unrepentant from his cell to the noose. But we did find one letter from Sunny himself. It was Friday, 3rd of February. And in 3 days' time, Sunny knew he would be sentenced to death by hanging. He had been writing coded letters to escape. But this time, he didn't think about coding the letters anymore. Instead, he wanted to write how he felt with someone who had been with him for a long time while he was still in prison. Reverend Ku Xiao Hua, who had just baptized him today. He picked up his pen and began writing. Dear Reverend Ko, there is so much that I want to say to you, but I'm finding it very difficult to put my thoughts into words. So forgive me for this, my farewell letter, being so brief and I fear incoherent. Do you remember the day you first saw me here? How I kept repeating to you, I'm an atheist, almost with pride. But as I watched you come here so often, spending so much of your time and giving so much of yourself to the Pulau Senang boys and the rest of us, expecting and receiving nothing in return, I asked myself, what is it that motivated this man to such altruistic acts? Is there really a God, as he undoubtedly believes? This, plus my brother Victor's example, led me to spend hours on end pondering over the questions of life, death, the existence of God, the truth of the Bible, and other related matters, my mind ranging far and wide into the hitherto unexplored realms. The conclusion I came to were foregone, but I still refused to open my heart to God, as I had some unfinished business to carry out, this vendetta. Months passed, without any change. But one day, the 17th of December 1966, for no apparent reason, I was overwhelmed by a desire to kneel down in prayer and pour out my heart to God, surrendering myself to Him and admitting to Him that revenge was in my heart. He listened and understood. And as I got to know Him better through the succeeding days and weeks, He told me that I should be above revenge and hate, that only love and understanding should occupy my thoughts and guide my actions. How I wished I could have met you in less tragic circumstances and derived the benefit of your causes. But I nevertheless thank you for everything that you have done for me and will be doing for me in the next few days. Through you, I found Christ, and through Him, I shall find the kingdom of heaven. We'll meet again in happier circumstances. Till then, fare thee well. Yours in Christ, Sunny Ang. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Heinous, an Asian true crime podcast brought to you by MediaCorp and produced by One Up Media. If you would like to share some feedback or suggest other cases that you would like us to cover, you can reach out to us via email at heinous@oneupmediapodcast.com or through our Instagram or TikTok page at heinous_oneupmedia. This episode of Heinous was researched, produced, and written by Yeo Gwang-jin, with audio engineering by Ethan Sam. Special thanks as well to executive producers Danny Cordy, Barry Toh from MediaCorp. We hope to see you again soon in the next episode of Heinous.